Hello, and welcome to Words on Film, the spoken word podcast dedicated to moving pictures. I'm Dan Burke, your host and movie critic, and I'm here to tell you exactly what I think of some of the latest movies out right now.
For this show, I have three brand new movies to review for you, and by brand new, I mean movies that have come out on streaming platforms within the last 2 weeks. And there's one that came out a couple of months ago, but I didn't get to review it until now. It's kind of been on my list, and I hadn't gotten to finish it until yesterday. So I got a little bit of catching up to do. One of the movies that I will not be reviewing, I'm sorry to say, on this show is the movie Mulan, the live-action remake of the 1998 Disney animated film that I actually think merits a live-action remake, unlike Beauty and the Beast and The Lion King and other movies that Disney has remade and exploited for a cheap buck. Not all of them, not all Disney remakes are bad, but the thing about Beauty and the Beast and The Lion King is that they were already great movies when they were animated anyway. Why remake them, let alone remake them as live-action films? I don't know. But getting back to Mulan, I was very eager to see the live-action remake of Mulan. Not that I thought that the animated version was bad. It wasn't. It was actually very good. It was significantly underrated, and it certainly wasn't the biggest hit of the 90s that Disney had in the animation department. But I was eager to see the remake. Why didn't I see it? Here's why. Because it is on Disney Plus, and I've been telling you guys for weeks, for those of you who have been paying attention, that I don't have Disney Plus. Well, now I do. I have finally bitten the bullet and subscribed to Disney Plus, and I probably won't be letting go of it anytime soon. And I'm very excited about it because there are a lot of new movies or newish movies on which I need to catch up on that platform. But Disney Plus has not been around for a full year, so I don't have as much catching up to do as I would on Netflix. So why didn't I see Mulan if I already have Disney Plus? Well, the reason for that is because Disney Plus has this promotion, and it's not really a promotion because you don't save money from it, but they have a premiere option where you can watch the live-action remake of Mulan and only the live remake action of only that movie if you pay $30. And the $30 is a one-time fee, but even still, I see a vast majority of the movies that I see only once. I don't really need to see them again. Plus, given my schedule of having one full-time job, two part-time jobs, and hosting the show in addition to that, I don't have time to see movies more than once, even if I want to, a lot of the time. But if I'm going to pay $30 to see a brand new movie, I better get a Blu-ray copy that's autographed by the principal cast in my possession. Otherwise, I'm not going to pay $30 for a movie that I'm going to stream. So Disney Plus does not have it this way where it's going to be $30 from now into indefinitely. Instead, what they're going to do is they're going to release Mulan at the same time as all their other films. In other words, people who are just paying the $7 a month, like myself, for Disney Plus are going to be seeing Mulan in their roster of other movies and TV shows in December. In that case for me, since December is actually only about 3 months away, it's worth the wait. And I'm not going to shell out $30 to see a movie I may or may not like. And usually when it comes to seeing a new movie, I try not to read the reviews. I avoid Rotten Tomatoes like the plague until I see a movie, and I try my best. I don't always succeed, but I try to not let other critics' opinions influence mine. Again, I don't always succeed, but I try. But in this case, I did check the other reviews of Mulan to see if it was worth my time and money. And the reviews have mainly been mixed. If they were overwhelmingly positive, For instance, on Rotten Tomatoes, if it was not only fresh but certified fresh, i.e. in the 90th percentile, then maybe, just maybe, I would see Mulan. But in this case, no, I'm just going to stick to the animated version that I really like. And I went to see that when it was brand new in theaters in June of 1998. I loved it. I thought it was an excellent film. I think not enough people saw it when it was in theaters, but it's gotten the appreciation that it deserved when it was released eventually on VHS and probably even more so later on DVD. But I'm digressing a little bit. My point is that if you don't feel particularly motivated to see the live-action remake of Mulan and pay $30 to see it, then by all means, don't do it. I'm not going to do it, and neither should you. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The first movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is I'm Thinking of Ending Things, which is a Netflix original that premiered on Netflix on September 4th, 2020. It is directed, written for the screen, and produced by Charlie Kaufman. And Charlie Kaufman, for those people who don't know, is a great writer and director in his own right. In terms of directing, he hasn't directed too many movies as of recently, but all the movies which he has directed has gotten a lot of great word-of-mouth praise, not to mention some critical praise as well. He made his directorial debut in 2008 with a movie starring Philip Seymour Hoffman, which is called Synecdoche, New York. And he also directed an animated film, a stop-motion animated film in 2015, which was called Anomalisa, which I thought was one of the best films of 2015, certainly one of the best animated films. Although, if you know anything about Charlie Kaufman, you have to know this. Charlie Kaufman is very, very weird. Very weird. And amazingly, he's not related to Andy Kaufman, but if somebody told me that he was, I'd absolutely believe it, but he's a little bit deeper than Andy Kaufman. But before he directed Anomalisa and Synecdoche, New York, he was best known for being a screenwriter, having written such movies as Being John Malkovich, Adaptation, and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. The former two movies were directed by Spike Jonze, who's a great director of movies and music videos. I mean, some of Spike Jonze's music videos are amazing. But Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind was also directed by an equally talented director of movies and music videos, Michel Gondry. And yeah, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind came out when I was in college. And about a year after it came out in theaters, it was the movie to watch amongst my college peers. But yeah, Charlie Kaufman is an immensely talented writer and director, but he's not to everyone's taste. And the movie I'm Thinking of Ending Things will definitely turn some people off. I'm Thinking of Ending Things is a movie that's very hard to explain, but the main synopsis of it is this. Full of misgivings, a young woman, who's actually not given a name in this movie, surprisingly, she's only credited as Young Woman, but she travels with her new boyfriend to his parents' secluded farm. Upon arriving, she comes to question everything she thought she knew about him and herself. It's based on a novel of the same name written by Ian Reid, which I haven't read yet, but I'm very eager to read it, no pun intended. But the young woman in the film is played by an actress by the name of Jessie Buckley. And Jessie Buckley is a delightful redhead who has acted in such movies as Wild Rose, which came out in 2018, which is a movie I really wanted to see, especially considering that Wild Rose takes place in Nashville, And I live in Nashville now. So I really wanted to see that, but unfortunately that got away from me. But maybe I'll see it a little later. She recently co-starred with Renee Zellweger in the movie Judy, where she played a young woman by the name of Rosalind Wilder. Some of her other movies include Beast, which is a dark adaptation of Beauty and the Beast, and another movie in 2017 called Taboo. She's an Irish actress, and she's, certainly made a name for herself in those movies. I believe this is her second starring role after the movie I just mentioned about the woman in Nashville, who's actually an Irish woman who wants to be a country star. I will see that movie someday, mark my words. The boyfriend of this young woman in the movie is played by an actor named Jesse Plemons, who's probably best known for his supporting role in the show Breaking Bad, where he plays a guy who looks like Richie Cunningham, you know, very clean cut and very polite, but he is actually a really dark person. And if you haven't seen Breaking Bad, then I won't spoil it for you, but he's one of the most spiteful people in that show, despite looking relatively unassuming. But that goes to show how good an actor Jesse Plemons is. And his parents in the movie, who are just known as mother and father, are played by Toni Collette and David Thewlis, respectively. Toni Collette really needs no introduction. She actually has gotten nominated for fewer Academy Awards than she deserves to have gotten nominated for, but I think she's actually as great an actress as Meryl Streep. Now, what's interesting about Toni Collette and David Thewlis in this movie is that Toni Collette is Australian and yet has an American accent in this movie, and David Thewlis, who is British, doesn't. And when you're introduced to these two people, It kind of surprised me that Jesse Buckley's character never nudged Jesse Plemons' character and said, why is your father British? Or not why is your father British, but how did he come to this country? I mean, she would at least want to know his backstory, right? Well, there are a lot of things about this movie besides David Thewlis' character's nationality that don't make a lot of sense. And David Thewlis' character's nationality is not one of the most puzzling things about this movie. What's puzzling is just about everything else. And I told you earlier about a rule I have about movies where I usually don't see movies more than once. The only exceptions are movies that I come back to again and again, either some of my favorite movies like M, It's a Wonderful Life, and Who Framed Roger Rabbit, just to name a few, you know, movies that are worth seeing again and again, or movies that require a second or third viewing. And I think that I'm Thinking of Ending Things is one of those movies. It is like being in a really bad dream. But even though this movie has been described as a horror, it's actually more like a drama and a thriller movie. And I can certainly see a lot more influence in Charlie Kaufman here from other directors like David Finch or Alejandro Jodorowsky than I would maybe Charlie Kaufman's own original ideas. And I'm sure that Charlie Kaufman has taken some inspiration, if not from the directors that I've mentioned, then other avant-garde directors like it. But rest assured, I think Charlie Kaufman is a great director. He certainly has a unique vision. And for some odd reason, I think he has the clout in Hollywood. And I think having an Academy Award, which he won for Best Original Screenplay for Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind back in 2005, certainly adds to that filmmaking credibility. I think he, the Coen brothers, and some other unique writers and directors seemingly are able to make movies without the bigwigs in Hollywood interfering with them. And I do also think that Netflix, probably more than any other movie studios, gives their directors, or at least I assume they give their directors and filmmakers, a lot more artistic control than other studios would. And I think main the reason for that is because Netflix has less to lose than some of these other major studios, like Disney, Paramount, 20th Century Fox, which is owned by Disney now, but you know what I mean. But these other movie studios of the last literally 90 years have to rely on people going out to the movie theaters to see these films. I mean, that's where they get the bulk of their money. Granted, some of it comes from DVD and Blu-ray sales or from pay-per-view, but even those sources are dwindling. And I think Netflix has a very solid foundation where they can let directors do what they want. And for the most part, at least from my observation, that seems to be working well for a lot of filmmakers. And Charlie Kaufman is certainly no exception to this rule. Now, I do say again, this film is not for everyone. Some people are going to see this film and absolutely hate it. I don't. I think it is a very unique film. It's not scary, but it is chilling. And I liked the fact that I didn't exactly know where the movie was going. Some people are going to hate that. Some people like the 7 to 14 basic plots of Hollywood movies. But I like it when somebody carves a 15th or 16th plot for themselves. And I didn't know where I'm Thinking of Ending Things was going. It did feel like a dream. And I liked it for that reason. I especially loved the acting by everyone involved, but most especially the four principal actors, Jesse Buckley, Jesse Plemons, Toni Collette, and David Thewlis. And I'm Thinking of Ending Things is, in my book, a knockout. It is a bizarre, bizarre movie that feels like a fever dream or a mildly bad acid trip, but I loved it for its boldness, its originality, its acting, its cinematography, its set design. There was a lot more I loved about this movie than I hated, and I'm highly recommending I'm Thinking of Ending Things for those reasons, but be warned, it is not for everyone. Back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I'm your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Love Guaranteed. This is not related to the movie Love Actually, but like Love Actually, Love Guaranteed is a romantic comedy. It just focuses on two people rather than Love Actually, which focused on, I think, about 20 people. It was kind of ridiculous how many people were in that movie, but I'm not taking anything away from that film. I'm just saying Love Guaranteed and Love Actually are not the same film made by the same person. But Love Guaranteed is a romantic comedy, and it stars Rachel Lee Cook, who I haven't seen for a really long time outside of Hallmark films, and it co-stars Damon Wayans Jr. And Damon Wayans Jr. has been in some good films and some bad films, and he's been in some good TV shows like New Girl, for instance. But Damon Wayans Jr., even when I've seen him in a bad film, I've actually been really impressed by his acting talent. And I will say, and without taking it back, and I've said this for years, that Damon Wayans Jr. is more versatile an actor and a better actor than his father, who, of course, is Damon Wayans. Now, Damon Wayans is funny, but I just feel like whenever Damon Wayans is in a movie, he plays either a complete imbecile, like in Blank Man, or I think probably 8 times out of 10, he plays a jerk. And if you haven't seen any of Damon Wayans' movies, but you've seen him on In Living Color, basically he plays Homie the Clown in just about every other film he's in, except maybe Blank Man and Bamboozled. He always plays, in other words, a jerk. And that's usually his go-to trait. If you've seen movies like Major Pain, Celtic Pride, The Great White Hype, yeah, that's basically Damon Wayans' calling card there. But with that said, Damon Wayans is actually a better actor than his brothers Sean Wayans and Marlon Wayans, especially Marlon Wayans. But my point is that Damon Wayans Jr. is actually a very good actor, and this movie is no exception. So the movie, Love Guaranteed, what is it about? To save her small law firm, earnest lawyer Susan, played by Rachel Lee Cook, takes a high-paying case from Nick, played by Damon Wayans Jr., a charming new client who wants to sue a dating website that guarantees love. But as the case heats up, as you might expect, so do Susan and Nick's feelings for each other. So the relationship here between the characters of Susan and Nick, Rachel Lee Cook and Damon Wayans Jr. respectively, is the least surprising part of this movie. But I actually did like the idea that a guy, you know, who goes out on nearly 1,000 dates could potentially sue a dating website that guarantees they'll find their true love. I liked that aspect of it. And would it actually happen in real life? Yeah, I think it would, especially since we live in an age where people can sue somebody for just about anything. It's only a matter of whether or not a district judge is going to throw the case out or not. But it is possible that somebody could not find love on a site like Match, OkCupid, eHarmony.com, and sue the website for not being able to do so. But with that said, I think a lot of those higher profile dating websites probably have clauses in their fine print that are lawsuit proof. But if somebody's not careful, even a high profile dating website, it could potentially happen. So I liked that idea, and I think the movie was smart enough to take this kind of idea seriously. But on the same token, the character that Damon Wayans Jr. plays in this film, whose name is Nick Evans, is indeed a charming guy, but he claims to have gone out on 986 dates, which seems implausible. And it is implausible, but not impossible. It is possible for this guy to go out on nearly 1,000 dates because he goes out with a different woman at breakfast, lunch, and dinner. How he is able to afford that on the salary of the job which he has, which is not a personal trainer, but somebody who rehabilitates people, it just seems highly implausible to me. Plus, when you see Damon Wayans Jr.'s character in this apartment that he owns, which is in Seattle, it's a luxury apartment. So how is he able to afford to live in that apartment and go out with three women a day, just about every day, for a little under a year is hard for me to believe, but I suppose it's not impossible. But I do think the movie has a good idea for the premise. But again, the relationship that cooks up between Rachel Lee Cook and Damon Wayans Jr. in this movie is not altogether surprising. But at the same token, I do think that the both of them have wonderful chemistry together, and I think that's what really elevates this movie. And Rachel Lee Cook is one of these actresses who I have liked since I've seen her in She's All That, and I haven't seen all of Josie and the Pussycats, but I liked her in it. But she is one of these actresses very much like Lacey Chabert and Tatiana Lee and Candace Cameron Bure, who is delegated to either Lifetime or Hallmark romantic comedies, especially ones that take place during Christmas. And it's really too bad, because maybe not like Candace Cameron Bure, but more like Lacey Chabert and Tatiana Ali, they seem way too talented as actresses, not just in the beauty department. All three of these actresses are beautiful, but I feel like they could do better than Hallmark movies. With that said, even though they're not having the same kinds of movie roles as Julia Roberts or Meryl Streep, they still are making an honest living, and it's not in pornography, so I give them credit for that. But my point is that Rachel Lee Cook is a better actress than her roles in Hallmark movies give her credit for being. But you might be wondering, what would possibly be the difference between Love Guaranteed and the movies you see on the Hallmark Channel or Lifetime? And that is a fair question. And here's my take on it. While I haven't seen a lot of Hallmark or Lifetime romantic comedies, I have seen some, and many of them are all the same. There is this woman who is usually white, but not always. She is in her late 20s or early 30s. She has a six-figure job and lives in a squeaky clean city. And even if it's in a city like New York, you know from when they're filming it that they probably filmed it in a much cleaner city like Toronto or Vancouver, because those are the go-to cities for American filmmakers. And the men that are their Prince Charmings, sometimes literally, sometimes figuratively, are always these picture-perfect guys who have less of a personality than the models in the J. Crew catalog. So that, to me, is what the difference is between movies that are cookie-cutter, standard-format romantic comedies that you find on Hallmark and Lifetime, and other romantic comedies, maybe not those that are necessarily released in theaters, but those that have actual heart and brains put into them. So you could argue that the relationship in this movie between Rachel Lee Cook and Damon Wayans Jr. is predictable, and you would be right. But there are great authors like Ernest Hemingway who have taken the romantic comedy or romantic drama plot formula and incorporated it into their stories and still created great stories. So it's not always the predictability of the stories that's a detriment to the standard pulp fiction, for lack of a better word. It's mainly what sells the movie is the characters, their situations, the heart that's put into the movie, and I think that Love Guaranteed has a lot of heart put into it, and for that reason, I give it full credit. And there's also, I should note, a very entertaining supporting performance in this movie by Heather Graham, who plays a woman by the name of Tamara Taylor, the CEO of this dating website called Love Guaranteed. She is a billionaire. She's very spiritual and, you know, kind of acts like a guru. She plays a similar role to the one she played in another Netflix original that came out a little while ago called Desperados. And I commented that Heather Graham's character in that movie was not necessary. But in this movie, she plays the same kind of character, but her character works really well. And Heather Graham, believe it or not, is really funny in this movie. And I haven't seen Heather Graham be funny in a movie since Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me. So it's great to see an actress who's in her 40s, who's been around for a while, but hasn't quite had the kind of longevity in her career that, say, Julia Roberts has had. It's good to see somebody like that, who's kind of grown beyond being an it girl or a sex symbol like she was in her 20s. It's great to see her go beyond that. She still looks good for her age, don't get me wrong, but it's great to see somebody show more versatility in their acting. So Love Guaranteed had some predictable moments, but when it comes to charming a jaded film critic like me, it actually succeeded. And for that reason, while I was debating giving it either a knockout or a checkout, and I was kind of on the border, I am going to give it a knockout. And the main reason for that is because Rachel Lee Cook and Damon Wayans Jr. in this movie are wonderful. They have such chemistry in this film. They play the characters as fully fleshed out round characters, and the movie is indeed smart. Now, I should also mention that there is a YouTube channel called LegalZoom where this real life lawyer takes movies with lawyers in them, either comedies or dramas. Like, for instance, he's reviewed My Cousin Vinny and A Time to Kill, just to name a couple of lawyer films that he's reviewed. And I always kind of, I want him to review this movie because I'm wondering about the legal accuracy of this movie, whether or not this case would be merited in court or not, and if the plaintiff could actually win if this movie was, or if this kind of case was brought to a real court. I would love to know that. But I'm not a legal expert. All I know is a good movie when I see one. And Love Guaranteed is certainly an exceptional romantic comedy and a very good movie. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Rising Phoenix. Rising Phoenix is a documentary that is also a Netflix original that premiered on the platform on August 26th, 2020. And this is a movie about the history and current standing of the Paralympic Games, which has grown to become the world's third largest sporting event. My guess is that the first largest sporting event is the Olympics, and the second largest is something having to do with international football. At least that's what I imagine it would be. But the Paralympic Games are part of the Olympic Games and the Winter and Summer Paralympic Games. Obviously, the Summer Paralympics are more popular than the Winter Olympics, but they're held concurrently with the Olympic Games and in the same city. I said this last week, but for those of you who didn't listen, and I assume that's most of you, I will say this. The Paralympic Games are not the same as the Special Olympic Games. The Paralympic Games started in 1960. The Special Olympics started in the 80s. And the Paralympic Games happen every 4 years. The Winter and Summer Paralympics happen 4 years apart. And the Special Olympics happen once every year. And they are not at all related. Also, another difference is that the Paralympics are for physically handicapped people, whereas the Special Olympics are specifically for mentally and physically handicapped people. I should say mentally and/or physically handicapped people. And I don't think that somebody who's mentally handicapped is necessarily barred from participating in the Olympic Games, the Olympics or the Paralympics, but the Special Olympics are made especially for them. But Rising Phoenix tells a story about several Paralympic athletes of all nationalities, all races, and all creeds who find their calling in the Paralympic Games. And it really is something that is a wonder to behold when you're watching this film. Some of the stories of some of these Olympic athletes, how they lost their limbs, because all of them have lost one or more limbs, either one of their arms, one of their legs, or more. And it's very impressive to see these people persevere and work their heart and body out in order to thrive in these Paralympic Games. Before Rising Phoenix, there was an eye-opening documentary that came out in 2005, which was released by Paramount Pictures in conjunction with MTV Films, that was called Murder Ball. And that detailed the game, well, its slang term was Murder Ball, but it's probably best known as Wheelchair Rugby. And Murder Ball is actually probably a more acceptable term. Yeah, because Wheelchair Rugby sounds compromising. But that just tells the story of one Paralympic sport, but it tells some fascinating stories about the people who participate in those sports and also how they got into wheelchairs. Some people were born without the use of their legs. Some people had become paraplegic or quadriplegic from a freak accident like a car accident, and others were born with polio. In Rising Phoenix, you hear about some people who were born without limbs. You hear about some people who actually lost their limbs because of diseases like meningococcal meningitis. And there's one especially sad story about an African refugee who, when he was 3 years old, got his leg hacked off by a machete or by somebody who was wielding a machete. And if that's not bad enough, he actually saw his mother and his sister get killed by the same person. Amazingly, this guy went on to participate in the Paralympics. Not only participate, but thrive in it. But can you imagine being 3 years old And I'm getting tears in my eyes when I'm talking about this. But can you imagine facing that much? Oh, I don't even have a word for it. Just, I can't imagine facing more drama in when you're 3 years old than most people face in their lifetime. But still, what's even inspiring about this is they could have, a person like this could have killed themselves or resorted to drugs and crime, and you wouldn't blame them for doing so. But it's even more inspiring for everyone to see somebody like this persevere in the Paralympic Games. And it really is a testament to how much of a difference the Paralympic Games make on the athletes that participate in them. And it goes without saying that it also makes a difference to the people who actually watch the Paralympic Games. And while the Paralympic Games don't get the same kind of media coverage as the Olympic Games, the documentary Rising Phoenix makes an argument that maybe they probably should. I know that if the Olympics and the Paralympics were being held this year, 2020, in Japan, like they should have been, I'd want to see the Paralympic Games. I'd especially want to see a game of murder ball. That sounds like not just inspiring, but like a really good time to watch as well. I'd watch the hell out of that. But it goes without saying that Rising Phoenix not only not only shows you a handful of inspiring athletes who really should be at least, if not an inspiration, an eye-opening experience for people who may not have had as many disadvantages as these people had, but it's also incredibly well shot and also gives a very detailed history about the Paralympic Games, like how they came to be, and the doctor that started them, who actually came dangerously close to being killed in Nazi Germany. And it's amazing that somebody could escape Nazi Germany, persevere, and do something for the patients that he treated. It took a long time from 1948 to 1960, but finally the Olympic Committee embraced the Paralympic Games. The exceptions are 1980, when Moscow refused to have the Paralympic Games, but that's actually not too much of a loss because many countries, including the United States, boycotted Moscow in the 80s, which was a hugely controversial move and may have been one of the contributing factors that cost President Jimmy Carter his second term in office. It wasn't the only reason, but it was one of the big reasons. But also, maybe this documentary argues that boycotting Moscow might have been a better thing than a lot of Americans realized. But also, the Brazil Games in 2016 came very, very close to canceling the Paralympic Games, but it was with the support, as this movie demonstrates, of the people behind the Paralympic Games that they finally went on in Rio de Janeiro. So I've been talking a lot about the importance of the Paralympic Games, as well as how well this documentary was shot. And I stand by that, which is why it's probably no surprise to any of you that I'm giving Rising Phoenix my highest rating of a very enthusiastic knockout. It is directed by Ian Bonhote and Peter Ettigui, and I'm not sure what their connection is to the Paralympic Games, but it's great that they released this documentary, Rising Phoenix, and this is a documentary that, if I see it again, I'm definitely going to show it to friends and maybe even family members who are interested in seeing a fascinating documentary about an unparalleled subject. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Adieu. This is a movie that details three people, three stories, and one thing in common, which is Africa. In other words, they all take place in Africa. And it tells three different stories, one about a white soldier in Africa who is on the border of Cameroon, which is one of the Spanish-speaking countries in Africa. There is a second story about a young woman who's trying to reunite with her estranged father, also in Cameroon. And the third story, which this movie should have focused on the most, was the story about a young boy from Cameroon who, along with his sister, is attempting to escape Cameroon for Europe. And he has a lot of trouble doing that. In fact, he's probably lived more lives as a young kid who's probably no older than seven than most people have in their entire life. His journey to a better place is fraught with tragedy. And I really thought that the movie should have focused on this kid, Adieu, whose character is the movie's namesake. And I really liked the scenes between this young kid. His name in the movie is Adieu, and he's played by a young actor by the name of Mostafa Omaru. And he eventually befriends another runaway orphan who's significantly older than him, probably close to 18, whose name is Massar, who is fluent in Spanish and English, and he's played by a very talented young actor named Adam Noru. And whenever this movie got to the part about the Cameroonian border guard and the teenage girl who's trying to track down her father, I didn't become particularly interested in those stories. I really wanted them to go back to the story of Adieu and his quest to find a world with stability along with his sister, and also the sketchy underworld from which he tries to escape. And the heights at which he is trying to seek refuge as a refugee is probably the story of thousands, if not millions, of refugees who live in third world and or war-torn countries. And seeing a movie like this, the same as the movie El Norte from 1983, which tells the story of two Venezuelan siblings who immigrate to the United States, really makes you think differently about immigration and how there are refugees who come from second and third world countries who come to either Western Europe or the United States and Canada solely to seek a better life for themselves. And there are politicians who go out of their way to stop them from doing so. And in the meantime, there are orphanages full of young refugees who are just abandoned in this world. And it's really sad. And I feel like this movie should have told the story of that one kid. And the other two stories, even though they had their eye-opening moments, didn't strike me as much as the one story about that child, Adieu. And I think that one third of this movie is good. And the other two thirds, the other two stories are decent, but I thought if you were going to make an anthology movie, I don't think it should have been one of those anthology movies where it cuts back and forth between the three stories. I think it should have been a typical anthology story where it tells one story, then that story's dropped and it tells another story, and so on and so forth. I think that's the best way to tell an anthology story. And I would have liked for these stories to have been linked in a better way besides taking place at the same time in the same country. You know, I would have liked to have seen these characters interact more. And I think that would have justified all these three stories. And I think they should have had one more thing in common besides geographic area. But I did appreciate Adu. I would not be entirely surprised to see this movie get nominated for Best Foreign Language Feature at the Oscars, or whatever they call that award now. I can't quite remember the award, but Adu gets my rating of a checkout. If it had just focused on Adu, or if it had been a little bit more organized and pragmatic in its approach to telling the other two stories, I think it would have deserved, in my book, a knockout. But as it was, it kind of got its three stories lost in its own shuffle. But I did enjoy it for what it's worth, and the story of Adu was heartbreaking in a lot of instances, and did end, without spoiling anything, on a questionable note, but not a bad note, not an inappropriate note or an unrealistic note. I just wish, for a movie that's called Adu, which is about a young child from Cameroon named Adu, it should have been just about him. And if not, it should have been called something like African Stories, and there should have been a lot more linkage to it besides just geography. Back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I'm your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. And now that I have reviewed all the movies that I have to review for you for this show, it's now time for me to get into a brief synopsis of movies that are coming out the week of Sunday, September 6th through Friday, September 11th, 2020. And I'll try to go through this as quickly as I can. There are a few movies that are Netflix originals that are coming out this week. One is a documentary that's coming out on Monday, September 7th, and it's called My Octopus Teacher, which is a documentary, not an animated film, but if it was an animated film, I would love to see it. But My Octopus Teacher is indeed a documentary, and it is about a filmmaker who forges an unusual friendship with an octopus living in a South African kelp forest, learning as the animal shares the mysteries of her world. That sounds like a fascinating environmental documentary. I will definitely seek that out, and hopefully I'll be able to review it for you for next week's show. As for Monday, that's the only Netflix original that's going to be premiering. The other movies that are going to be premiering on Netflix, or let me just say recurring on Netflix, are one documentary, which is a fascinating one, called Waiting for Superman, which has a lot to say about the American educational system, which hasn't changed since the movie's come out, I'm sorry to say. But this is one of those movies that, like An Inconvenient Truth, which is by the same director, by the way, should change the world a lot more than it actually has. But that's no fault on the documentary itself. It's the fault of the people who don't watch it or who are too narrow-minded to take the time to watch it. And those politicians in Washington, you know exactly who you are. So there are a couple of movies that are coming out on Wednesday, September 9th. There's one that's called Corazon Ayoko, or So Much Love to Give. It's Corazon Loco, which literally means crazy heart, but its English name is So Much Love to Give. And Corazon Loco is a Netflix original. Let's see. Yeah, one of these. Okay, I can't find any information on it, but let me just read to you what the other movies that are premiering this week are. There's La Línea Shadow of Narco, which is a documentary that sounds very good. There's another Netflix original that's called The Social Dilemma, which is also premiering, like those other two documentaries, on Wednesday, September 9th. And The Social Dilemma might be a movie that is critiquing social media, because there is a trend right now for people to leave their social media accounts, whether it be Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whatever. But here's the synopsis of it. Never before have a handful of tech designers had such control over the way billions of us think, act, and live. Silicon Valley insiders reveal how social media platforms are reprogramming society by exposing the other side of your screen. This has a lot of bold claims to make, and they may or may not be entirely inaccurate. But this is a movie that doesn't sound particularly like propaganda. But this is a movie that I'm interested in seeing, particularly because I have a few social media accounts. I have a Facebook and Twitter account. I haven't gotten into Instagram, and I don't think I ever will, but I won't say never to that. But I am worried about the influence that social media has on this world, and also how much time I spend on social media, even though I swear I don't spend any more than an hour on social media. But some people spend a lot more time on there. But any event, The Social Dilemma is premiering on Netflix on Wednesday, September 4th. That is a movie I will see, and I will review it for you next week.
Well, that's all the time I have for this episode of Words on Film. I always love talking about movies, and I hope you liked what you heard. If you did, please subscribe and rate the show and leave comments if you can. I would love to get your feedback, even if it's more criticism than praise. This has been Words on Film. I'm Dan Burke, and until my next episode, I'll see you at the movies.